Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Talking to Death is released every Friday and brought to you absolutely free. But if you want ad-free listening and exclusive bonuses, subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus at tenderfootplus.com or on Apple Podcasts.
Talking to Death is a production of Tenderfoot TV and iHeart Podcasts. Listener discretion is advised.
Where you at, Mikey?
I am in my house. Where are you at? Is little you got your bed right there? Is that your bed?
No, it's not. It's a Airbnb bed.
Oh.
The hot water stopped working, and I took a cold shower this morning, and that was not cool.
It's good for
you. It's amazing how much they suck. You just might as well just not take a shower.
No, it's good for you. It closes the pores. I think you sweat less.
I'm still cold. That was like 4 hours ago. Well, we're back on Talking to Death. We wanted to jumpstart the episodes post Up and Vanish, which we'll come back to that same formula in June when the next 8 episodes come out. But today's guest is one of the funniest guys I've ever met in person. Also super kind. We recorded this in New York a few weeks ago, and he is one of the stars of the show Impractical Jokers. And if you haven't heard of that show, I don't know, you must not own a television, or you've never been to a hotel or prison, because it plays everywhere on cable TV. Joe Gatto is his name. And to be honest, I mean, I love all of the guys in Impractical Jokers. Sal, Murr, Q, I've always been a fan of that show. Think it's hilarious. They do the craziest shit to each other. But he is actually my favorite, because I think that his ability to get people convinced of pretty much anything is unmatched. He hands down wins almost every challenge, it seems like. Just convincing some person in the supermarket to do whatever. He's masterful at that, which I admire that. I think it's a weird, quirky skill. But we met, and he was so nice, actually. He brought us cupcakes. Remember that, Mike?
I do. He's so humble. He's so nice. No one's ever done that, by the way. No one's ever brought cupcakes to us.
And like, I don't know Joe like that. This is the first time we've ever met, and you know, he's more famous than me. I should have had cupcakes for him, but I didn't. But he came in with delicious cupcakes, and that was super nice. Or maybe he just left them in his car, and he was like, oh shit, maybe I should just bring these to them. Still a nice gesture, because they were good.
It could have been somebody just gave them to him, I don't want these.
Just the ultimate, like, regift timing, yeah. Like, ah, shit, what should I do with these? Oh, bring them to those podcast guys.
Oh, yeah.
Regifting isn't bad.
No. You still thought about it then. You didn't forget to get anything. You just went, hey, I have this thing that I'm not using. Maybe somebody else could use it.
Yeah,
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's if you've used it that it's bad.
Oh, you can't do that. You can't do that.
No.
Pre-chewed cupcakes? No.
There's sometimes it's bad. I mean, I gave my brother Mason for Christmas one year, like a nice bottle of whiskey. And then for my birthday, he gave me the same bottle of whiskey back. Like, and he had forgot that I given it to him. I was like, bro, like, is this the one that I gave you? He's like, oh, wait, was that you who gave me that? I'm like, yes. The fuck? Like,
yeah, but he aged it for you.
He did. Yep. He just kept it away from me for 6 months. Appreciate that. Yeah, that's the wrong way to do it. Just don't get caught regifting is the thing, I guess, right? Well, today's guest is Joe Gatto from Impractical Jokers. He's also a talented stand-up comedian, and he's been touring the country doing huge shows. He also has his own podcast called Two Cool Moms, which is hilarious. So please go check that out. Super glad that I got to meet with him and talk to him. And to be honest, the whole interview, I was like, I feel like I was laughing the whole time. It was just funny from the get-go. And we were able to talk about, you know, family and life and the struggles of, you know, being in this business and some deeper things too. But he was an open book and even funnier in person. I hit him with a nice, fun icebreaker question. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I wanted to set the tone. But he hit me right back and put me on the spot. But yeah, this is Talking to Death, and his name is Joe Gatto. So this will be super chill, fun. I've been a fan of yours forever. My podcast is called Talking to Death. I mean, I've been doing true crime shows forever, and eventually I just broke and said, okay, I'll just do like a regular podcast. as in like when you say podcast, people yeah. think this is what it is, right. But there's so many different versions of a podcast.
Oh my God,
now.
So many.
And so it's just been cool meeting people and just shooting shit, talking about life, and so many fun questions for you. So thanks again for being here.
You got it. Thank you for having me in this. Your New York studio.
Yeah, yeah. It's called the Roxy Hotel, and I hope right. you don't catch us. We didn't get a permit, I don't think. So.
Fine, it's just two friends talking in a microphone.
Yeah, like this is just for fun. That's yeah, there's no business involved here at all. So I was thinking last night, I wanted to like open up this interview with a fun icebreaker question.
Oh, okay.
And hopefully you haven't been asked it before, so I'm gonna do it. You'll be like, no, I have.
I haven't found him.
Yeah. So I want to play Fuck, Marry, Kill.
Okay.
Not
in real life.
No, in real
okay,
life.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I'm going to bring in three people.
We're going to bring in three people. We're going to play it live.
Yeah. We're going to cut the cameras off. Yeah. Fuck, Marry, Kill.
Yeah.
You ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. Should we wait for that siren to go, or is it too loud?
I guess you're the ambiance of New York.
Hey, Dave, we're New York City, baby.
Yeah, and we're playing Fuck, Marry, Kill. Sounds like the soundtrack.
Fuck, Marry, Kill.
Yeah.
Sal, Mur, or Q?
Well, Mur's dead instantly. You know Mur. Mur's the one we kill.
What was that?
Oh, because it's Murray, and you have to kill Murray.
No, but why, though?
You just have to. We don't go into detail about it. It's just he has to die.
This guy has to go.
Okay. This guy must go.
Delete him.
All right. No. I mean, Sal, I probably, Sal looks like he could be a provider in ways and a lover, a generous lover. So I would probably go with him to marry throughout my life. And then Q looks like a fun romp. I would go Q for I would F Q probably. And that would probably be my round out. Yeah.
Okay.
So it would be F to F Q. And it sounds like a letter game now. FQ.
What game are we playing?
Yeah. I marry Sal and I would kill Mur.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should I do mine now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
I'll put me in it.
Put you in it?
Yeah.
I'm going to fuck you.
Yeah. All right. In the hotel.
I think if I throw you in the mix, okay. Fucking Joe.
Yep.
I thought about marrying Mur.
Marrying Mur?
Maybe because he seems like a stable, like he might take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
I would either kill Sal. I might kill Sal too.
You kill
Sal. I love Sal, but yeah. I'm sorry, but if we have to play this game.
Well, Sal would be fun to kill. He's like, you know, no, don't do it. Oh, please stop. And it'd be easy too, right? You could just like throw a cat at him.
He'd be like, all the time. Like, he just died. Like, oh my God, that wasn't even part of the bit yet.
Didn't even mean it. Sorry, Sal. It's only a kitten.
So you started, you were guys in a comedy troupe years ago. And then you got the show Impractical Jokers, which is over a decade ago,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And so tell me about how you, like when you were going through that pilot season, what did you guys think this was going to be? What were you wanting to
nothing.
Do?
We were hoping to get episode two. We had no idea what it was.
So was it just a pilot episode one that you
no,
got?
No, we had gotten the order for the first series. But I mean, if you look at the first episode versus what it turned into, it was basically just a quick hit clip show. Of just us running around saying like punchlines. It evolved into a show finally. I mean, I think season one I think some of our episodes insanely had like five challenges and a punishment in it in 22 minutes. Like nothing could be set up or lived in or whatever, you know? So a big change for us came in season two when we decided to let everything breathe. And we were like, look, it can't be more than three challenges. And three even felt like a lot. I mean, there's some that had five in there. And it was just, you say something funny, it would cut out. Like that was it. You don't get the living in it. And that's what the show really became about, the awkwardness, uncomfortable of making your friends feel weird, you know? So I think that was a big part of what happened. And eventually that's what the show became. And more so it became on, if we peel back the curtain even more, was when you realize it was a show about friendship. And that's really what it was. It's just watching your friends make each other laugh. And that's what people really responded to. And I really think that's when the show really hit its stride. It's when we got to show the world. And I remember one of the moments that that happened was I was always very involved in the show, from writing all the way to editing, executive producing. You know, I quit my job. I was the first one to quit my job out of it.
You
full committed, because the other
guys
had jobs that they were able to do, because Q was a fireman, so he was able to do his night shifts and he would come to work. Sal was a bartender and owned a bar in Staten Island, so he would be able to juggle both. Mert was working for the production company that produced the show, so he was at work while he was working. And I worked as a baby store salesman at this place called Giggle that was a couple blocks from here.
A baby store?
Yes.
Baby store salesman?
Yeah.
What is that?
I sold high end on the market. High end furniture and baby gear.
Okay.
So I was a personal shopper here in Soho this like, you know, brand, which was, it was interesting and fun, but I had a 2-week vacation that I took to shoot the pilot. Then when they picked it up, I was like, hey, I need a 6-month hiatus. And the CEO was like, so you're quitting? I was like, well, no, it's a hiatus.
Cool. That means you're quitting.
Yeah. She's like, well, come back if you need to, but you're out. And I was like, okay. So
I love that leap though.
So when I jumped in, it was like, okay, how's this thing working? And I always wanted to be a writer and director. So I really loved the production part of it. So I jumped in and learned and loved that. So over the decade, I really, you know, really filled up my, you know, acumen for that. And then, so when we were doing it, I was like, oh, okay. So now I had submitted a cut to the network where we were working in a store or something, and nothing really that fun was happening. Somebody's turn, but I forget who's on the floor. It was either Q or me. And Mur asked Sal to borrow borrow his chapstick.
Okay.
And they got into this ridiculous debate that was just funny to watch and was funny. And I was watching it and I was like, this is funnier than anything that's happened. I was like, I'm putting this in. So we put it in and I sent in the clip, and then the notes came back and the network was like, hey, this is great, but this is kind of weird that we're just watching you guys talk. And then I said, and I, you know, got on the phone with them. I was like, this is the funniest thing that happened that day. People really like it. Just give it a shot. And I sent them those side by side of what it looked like with the other stuff in it. I was like, you can't tell me objectively this
you
is funny.
You compare them, say, hey,
yeah, look this is better than what's better. What's the better cut? And they're like, you're right, this is better. So we put it in, and then from that moment on, all of a sudden, everybody started to be like, oh, Sal's that kind of guy, and Murr's that kind of guy, and Joe's that kind of guy, because they got to see us talking and being ourselves, because we didn't play characters. We were us, you know?
Uh-huh.
And we had very distinct personalities, so it really was nice to make that come together. And we just fed that fire with different tactics to show us have more conversations, be it walk around the park when we're doing these bits for a while, where we would just get a topic, they would film us for a day, and we'd do circles in the park and just talk. And whatever was funny, we would just take out and put it in between challenges. And then you got to see our personality. And then eventually it came down to two challenges a show with a punishment, with a lot of time spent with us just talking and doing all these crazy things where people got to see us be us, you know.
You realized early on that really at least half of this show, this concept is your true friendship 100%. And your reactions and like you guys being in a group watching and saying, how can we mess with this guy right now?
Yeah. Well, the concept was from the jump was we had tried and failed multiple times with shows.
Okay.
And
like, give me like example, like
sketch shows where it was like sketch comedy stuff that was based on our real life, but exaggerated forms.
Right.
Like I was a salesman. Q was a fireman, but we had this weird, crazy world we were living in and stuff like that. And we
scripted
put sketches in between scripted.
Oh, nice.
And it was good. It was actually why we ended up getting our agents and stuff, because we submitted this. It was a crazy story. We won the most money ever on a failed pilot. There was this pilot for Fox called It's Your Show, where this happened back in like 2010, I guess, 2009, where people were trying to figure out now how everybody, like the internet became big and everybody was like, but TV's the medium. So how do we put all these funny sketch people that are on the internet on TV where everybody should be? So they came up with this formula for this show called It's Your Show, where it was hosted by Carson Daly. And it was basically America's Funniest Home Videos for sketch troops. They would give you a concept and you'd have to make a sketch about it. And they would show all the sketches. Carson would do a thing. It was a glossy studio with an audience. They would watch the sketches live and then people would vote on who they would want to win.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, before they had the studio audience, they did it on the internet. And we had been performing live in New York, had a huge mailing list, had a big following. So they started giving you these subjects and you had to say, okay, here's an idea. Okay, an invention. Make a funny thing about an invention. So we would make a sketch, submit it, people would vote, and you win $1,000. And we won 13 of those. So we won $13,000 cashing in. We were crushing. They were funny, and we got momentum. This is when, I don't know if you know YouTube, but YouTube.
I've heard of them. Yeah. Is that a Google thing?
Or? They were just starting. Them and MySpace were just starting, and they both found us funny. And this was back in the day when there was no algorithms, there was people that were like, hey, we should put this on the homepage. Hey, we should do this. And we had gotten fans inside those networks, mm-hmm. and they had started putting us and featuring us and blah, blah, blah. So we caught fire. So then they do the pilot for It's Your Show, hosted by Carson Daly, and it's $100,000 to the winner, and we end up winning, and the pilot doesn't happen, but they have to pay us. So we got $100,000.
We won all the ways.
Yeah. So we won all of it, and it never saw the light of day. But the guys who produced that show saw us, and we had to submit a tape that talked about us, so we did a really funny sketch tape, 8-minute tape, mm-hmm. with a little bit of personality about us. And they were like, these guys are a show. They should have their own show. And we started our Meet the Tenderloins, because our name of our troop was the Tenderloins. It was called Meet the Tenderloins. And it was basically just an exaggerated version of us. And we did a scripted show. It went for Spike. It didn't take. And then they passed. And then we tried another thing, didn't take. Then we tried another thing, didn't take. And then we were like at our wits' end. And I was like, we're all together and we're having sandwiches. Me and Murray live together. We have in our apartment. We were eating. The four of us were over. And they were like, let's just do a show that like shows us making each other laugh.
Yeah.
So we grabbed our cell phones and we did a sizzle tape of us out and about. Just this embarrassment comedy is always how I made these guys laugh.
On the iPhone.
So, yeah, six. That's it. So we're having our iPhone. Yeah, four, maybe five. Yeah. And we went in standard definition. Yeah. And we went into, it was Tyler Perry Presents Something in Times Square. And I just stood up in the middle of the place and announced to everybody that I farted. And then excused myself and apologized and walked down the middle of the thing. Not that I didn't go to the aisle. Front, I mean, I just cried, pretended like I went right down the front and the place went nuts and erupted and started laughing and clapping. And I like turned the whole place to be champions of myself, you know? Woo. And then we just did this whole sizzle tape and then we submitted it. And eventually we got Jokers at True. And then it just kept going. And that's it.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the whole, you know, the YouTube MySpace days, because I was around putting content like, on the internet back in those days, long time ago, before I did any true crime. I was in a band and I made my own music videos.
Oh yeah.
And I remember MySpace being a big one, right? Like there was a,
well, especially even for music, MySpace was huge too.
For sure. But they would feature videos, and if you were one of those featured videos, you were it.
Yeah.
And
that was the equivalent of the viral video now.
That was it. Like yeah, there was no other way. And yeah. I had a few of my videos featured on MySpace, and then we're like, hey, maybe this, we could do something with this. We started making our own music, and you know, the internet and social media has changed so much since then. Yeah. But I like your journey from throwing stuff out there on the early days. I mean, night and day from what it is today.
For sure.
But it seems like, you know, you did so many things before one thing worked that took over. And you just did more even after that. So tell me about, I guess, I don't want to really call them struggles, but they're just, they're struggles, but you're getting your reps in, like,
yeah.
This didn't happen overnight.
We're an 18-year overnight success. That's the joke I always made. I didn't get on TV till I was 34 years old.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Let's talk about that though. Yeah. So like, what is that to you? And what misconceptions are there about success in that way? Maybe you saw me for the first time on this TV show, but what about the 14 years before that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think the biggest misconception for everybody is that there's a defined path. There's not.
No.
I mean, you look at people that are, you know, Justin Bieber at 12 years old, you know, getting, crushing it and crushing it for his life. You know what I mean? Or there's people that sing their first song on stage, you know, when they're way later in life, you know, in their 30s, and then all of a sudden they're a superstar. So I think it's like, there's no defined path, so don't let anybody define it for you. That was the biggest thing for me. It was like, do what you love. I love to make people laugh. Always did it on the side as a hobby. I knew there was enough for there to keep it going for me, where it'd be my second job. I always said I had my 9 to 5 and my 5 to 9, and it was always just my 5 to 9 was, how can I make people laugh? I was editing videos. I was doing improv comedy shows here in the city. I was doing whatever I needed to do to like feed my soul. You know, so I think that's a big thing for everybody. It's just like, how did they do it? How'd they do it? There's no answer, man. It's just keep doing it and genuinely like what you're doing. You know, big thing for me was with the guys, we always had fun doing it. It's impossible to watch people who are having fun and not have fun yourself.
Absolutely.
So we always put on something that we thought was fun. And if people liked it, they liked it. And if they didn't, they didn't. So even with our show, some people will be like, my husband loves your show. I didn't really get it until I sat down and I started watching it. You know, because on paper, it's like these four old men, you know, middle-aged guys making fart jokes or whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. But then when you sit down and look at it, it's like, oh, I my friend's like that. Oh, I know a Sal. I know a cute, you know, and it really is a different thing. You just have to give it its time. So I think that's really a big part of it, was just do what you love and just don't worry about like how you're going to get there. Just get there.
Do you feel like part of your drive in the early days was just, if I can do what I love and be sustainable, then that's all I want?
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, it wasn't for money.
Right. Of course.
It was always the job. You
that
know?
Comes, so that's like an after thing.
Yeah. Right? So when I had to make the decision of, look, I'm leaving this. I built this career for over nine, you know, I was with that company for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I worked my way into their corporate position. I had a 401k. Like, it was like, well, you can do this to go take a chance on a thing that's going to fail.
Right.
The numbers say it's going
right.
to fail.
Statistically, right.
Statistically, it's failing.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way. You're on this small network in between two tow truck shows, by the way. We were after Lizard Lick Towing, before South Beach Tow. We were at the comedy show on a tow truck network, swear to God. So we're like, it's like, this is, there's no way this is going to work. And I was like, F it. I was like, I'm going to give it a shot.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. It was really just like, all right, it's time to give it a shot.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, I'll recover, you know, and if I make a move and if it doesn't work, I'll make a move back, you know, so.
You wanted the risk. You were willing to take the risk.
Sure. Sure. You know, and everything is a risk because you can get fired from your job tomorrow.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So it's like, what is that? What did that job, that company could have went under the next day and I'd be at square one anyway. So
yeah,
I think that's part of it.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you feel like, because you mentioned that you always knew that you liked to make people laugh.
Sure.
What's the earliest memory you have of, I mean, were you that kid? Were you the class clown? Were you, you know, when you were 5 years old, were you making your parents laugh? Or, like, what is like the youngest version of you where you were that funny guy?
Easter Sunday, 1986, Staten Island, the Bella Vita 2 Cafe. Me, my family are in this Italian, big Italian restaurant having our early lunch Sunday dinner. Mm-hmm. We're hanging out. I'm with my sister at that point. She's 13 years old. I'm 10. We hate each other. Now she's my best friend. I love her. Okay. We're in, back in the day, you were able to smoke in restaurants. My parents were smokers.
The good days.
Yes, they were good days. Now they were ruined with health. So there was which was so weird. They put you behind this glass door. So you're in an encased room where I feel like the cancer just amplified itself.
Your kids were getting cancer.
Yeah, so you had to open a door to walk out. So I'm walking out and we going down. I had to go to the bathroom. My dad sends my sister with me. We're walking through this packed restaurant in Staten Island. I miss a step. I fall smack hit hard, record scratch moment. The place, ooh, like one of those hits, right? Yeah. So I sit down, my sister above me goes, ha, 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 like laughing at me. And I remember just jumping up and going, ta-da, and the whole place lost it and they started clapping. And I looked at my sister and I flipped her off and I was like, oh, I can make people laugh. And that was fun.
Wow.
And I remember that moment and I've really, also, that helped tweak my shame gene where I'm not really get embarrassed easy or anything anymore.
Right.
I'm like, you know what? Who cares what people are thinking?
Exactly.
As long as I like what I'm doing and I'm happy about it. So that moment for me was like a moment in life that definitely changed my brain.
Honestly, I mean, kind of hearing that moment, I see a lot of similarities in your humor as a comedian today and all the stunts and stuff you did in
Physical Comedy.
Physical Jokers.
Yeah.
You like in a split second just said, gotcha, right? And just embraced it versus being like, oh no. When I've, like, man, I've seen, I mean, I don't even know how many episodes there are of Impractical.
I'm on
do
almost
you
like,
even know?
I'm over like 300 of them.
Yeah, yeah, 3 million or whatever it is.
Yeah. Nine and a half seasons I did. So I was like, it was like 300 episodes almost. Yeah.
You were always my favorite to watch because, and I mean this genuinely. And I would even point out to my friends, I was even telling, you know, this is Mike and Dylan, they're producers with me at Tenderfoot. And I was like, this is actually my favorite of the Impractical Jokers in terms of the skits that they do, because I feel like he can convince anyone of anything.
I'm a salesman, yeah.
and just the confidence level that you exude, it's like if you keep pushing it further, even when you think internally, there's no way they're going to buy this.
Yeah.
That almost becomes crazier than it being fake.
I remember early on when we were like, these people aren't going to believe this. And then I remember I was like, you know what? They will if we make it the reality. And we just did this whole thing where it was like, it was all really a social experiment thing in the beginning.
Yeah.
So then I remember there was this one challenge that we had on paper and it took us a while to try it. We had it on paper, like, we don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's work. We forgot about it. And then seasons later, we're like, what about that one? Because we've been in the public enough. We figured it out. We're like, oh, this will work. So it was one where we played janitors in a supermarket and we had to convince people to make a mess because we were up for our, we couldn't leave for our break until a mess was cleaned up. So we had to talk people into spilling gallons of milk or breaking eggs or whatever. So I remember there was this one woman and it was my turn and I went first that day. And I was like, and they gave you the sentence to say of why you had to do it. And the sentence they gave me was, come on, shorty, do the naughty. And that's what I had to say to this woman, right? So I go up to this woman, I go, hey, and I have the mop. I look very believable. I have a security like vest on. I have like a mop and bucket.
Why else would this guy be in?
Why is he? I'm in the middle of it. There's nobody else around us. So this woman walks over and she's looking. I said, listen, you got to do me a solid, shorty. And they all of a sudden they start laughing. And she's like, what? I was like, listen, I got to do the naughty. And I need you to do a naughty for me so I can get out of here. She's like, what are you talking about? I said, just drop this gallon of milk for me. And if you do it, I get to go on my break. And she's like, really? And like, she looked at me so into and I'm like, you gotta help me on. Please help me out, shorty. And she goes, okay, I'll do the naughty. And I said, okay, well, look, this is what I need you to do. And she goes, I got it. She figures it out on herself. She picks up the gallon of milk and goes, oh, drops it. And it makes a big splash. And we erupted. I'm like, I cannot believe that worked. And it was so easy.
Uh-huh.
It was so easy at that point because people want to help people. People are like, when you're out there, like you feel it, and when you feel that, like as terrible as the world could be sometimes, when you're on a human level talking to somebody and you put it out there, people are like, sure, I'm down for it. So we tore apart that supermarket for the next half hour. And it was unbelievable. So I remember seeing things like that and being like, oh, you have to sell it. You have to really get into it. And people didn't see on TV a lot. We always got in the beginning, this is planned, people know them, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, people didn't. And
that's just conspiracy stuff.
It's like, they knew this guy was on this episode, blah, blah, blah. But the big thing was for us is that we would talk to people for 10 minutes on that park bench normally before we started being weird.
Of course.
So like it was always like you, because you wanted also them to be a good person for the show. So you had to feel them out. Are they going to be a person that's going to give you comedy? Or are they going to be somebody to be like, oh, and clam up and walk away? You know?
Exactly.
So that was a big thing. And we'd always took risks with that stuff. One of my favorite moments I ever did on the show was when they gave me a punishment where they gave me sunscreen. They said you had to get sunscreen from top to bottom by strangers in the park. That was it. Just have strangers rub me. I was like, okay, fine, we'll do it. So we go out there, and as we start this, I'm sitting there in the park. We just get set up. I'm by myself. I'm in a thong, I think, and I'm hanging out there. And here comes this kid that goes to NYU. comes flying over. He's like, Joe, I'm a huge fan. I was like, hey, man, could you get my back? Just to him. And knowing he's a fan. And in my ear, Sal goes, oh, you know what? If you get him to empty the whole thing and do your whole body, this would be hysterical. But you can't let him know we're filming. I said, okay. So we start working it out in real time like that. I'm like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this kid do it the whole time. So like then we figured it out. Okay. But it all happened so fast that our producers don't even realize it. One of our producers comes over to get rid of the person.
Yeah.
And it's Pete McPartland, who's been on the show a bunch.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was our showrunner, and he's a great guy. And Pete comes over to be like, hey, excuse me. And Pete hasn't heard, because he's off walkie, hasn't heard me make the call. So I go to Pete, no, hey, buddy, good to see you. And Pete picks up on it because he knows me. And he goes, hey, man. And I was like, oh, yeah, good. I'll see you back at the office. And he walks away.
This is off day.
Then the kid goes, oh, wait, Pete's here? I go, yeah, our office is right there. I'm actually on break right now. And he goes, and I know, I see it's coming. And he goes, no. And he's like, no. And I took out the earpiece and I put it under my leg. I go, yeah, I'm just hanging out in the park getting tan. He goes, no. And he goes to look at my ear and the earpiece is out. I go, yeah, I'm not. And he goes, oh, really? And I'm like, oh, so where are you from? And then I put it back in and now we're off to the races. And this kid for the next 45 minutes put sunscreen on me from head to toe, doing my inner thigh as I'm talking to him about his major. And he just kept, and I had to keep convincing him that he's not on the show.
Right.
And it was one of the best moments. But those are the kind of things that you were able to do when you got to talk to people and immerse yourself in this weird reality. And people just came along for the ride, man. It was really, really cool. That's one of my favorite things that ever happened.
Those are like very interesting micro instances that happened that built up to the end result that you see, because there's no way you could ever pack all that into a 30 minute show.
Yeah, but that was a 6 minute thing on TV, and it was our day. It was an hour and a half.
That was the day. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So you have gone on tour. You've hit all 50 states?
All 50. Performed live comedy in all 50 states.
Okay.
So that was a bucket list thing for me last, and I hit it last year. I finished in Fargo, North Dakota. That was my last show.
That's actually a cool place to end it.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. Two shows. It was great.
Tell me why you wanted to hit all 50 states as a stand-up comedian.
Well, I was close with the guys. I had done 44. I was missing six states, and I was like, oh, come on, I can't be this close. And then I started touring solo, and I was like, you know what? I talked to my agent. I said, there's six states I haven't been to. Let's see if we could put it together. And he started putting it together. One of them was, I was going through some stuff personally, and I was taking a break with my wife, and sure. I was working all that out, and I would never been to Alaska. So I also took like a trip to be like, you know what, I'm just going to Alaska. And as I was going to Alaska, my agent called. He's like, hey, he's like, this is weird. We got an offer from the comedy club for you to do a show in Alaska. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be in Anchorage. I was like, could they do it then? He said, yeah. So I got to perform in Anchorage. I spent 4 days in Anchorage, which was really cool. And then I was like, oh, now I got to do it. I had already done Hawaii. I said, I did Alaska. The rest is here. I was like, come on, we got to hit all these. So I ended up doing Montana, Wyoming, and North Dakota is my last one. And then I ended up doing North Dakota, and that was my 50th one. And it was really just a cool thing to be like immersed with the people in these towns that don't really get big comedy acts that come through sometimes and just make people laugh. So that was really fun.
I mean, that's badass.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
Also, Anchorage, the next season of my true crime show called Up and Vanished, about missing persons cases, takes place in Alaska. Actually, comes out in a couple weeks.
Oh.
So we've spent, almost the better part of a year going back and forth to Anchorage and other small towns.
That's a heck
towns.
Of a trek.
So about to say, like, can we talk about how far away Alaska really is?
You don't realize it's like 8 hours from
Seattle. It's in Russia.
I know, basically. I know. It's insane. I couldn't believe it because they were like, oh, you're going to go to Juneau? Because, you know, that's way closer to Seattle. And I was like, no. I said, I had my heart set on going to Anchorage. They're like, oh, that's up there. And then you look on a map. I'm like, it's not up there. It's up and over there. It's crazy.
It's how far where it is. Santa Claus is.
I know. It really is. And I was almost one of those missing people in Anchorage, man. I went walking around. I pulled one of the best stunts ever on my sisters. Like, I'm really tight with my sisters, and they were really nervous that I was going to Anchorage by myself because they worry about me, the two older Italian sisters. And they're like, share your location. I'm like, you're going to come to Anchorage and get me? Like, if I get lost?
It'll take too long. I'll be missing. It's fine.
I'll be gone. So they had this animal rescue. I'm big into animal rescue. And they have this animal sanctuary out there in Anchorage. And I was like, oh, I'll go check out this animal sanctuary. And they had all these. It was a great way to see all the animals, you know, moose and all that. And they had these bears, and they had this bear enclosure. But the way the bear enclosure was there was you drove through this like big preserve, which was amazing. It was like hundreds of acres. And the way it's situated, the parking lot was lower than the mountain that the bears were on. So
why?
I don't, it was weird, but there was these big fences. So you were stopped from them. Okay. So I stood on the hood of my car and I did a selfie video, and it looked like I was just out in the wild. And I was like, and I'm ignoring this bear that's over my shoulder. And I go, hey, I just telling you how gorgeous Alaska is. And I sent a selfie video to my sister. I'm like, it's so, I was like, oh shit, what is that? And then I stopped recording. And I said it to my sisters, right? And they're like, and then it starts and ding, ding, what up, Joe? Oh my God, there's a bear behind you. Like, I didn't see it, right? So then I'm hysterical laughing, and I let it sit for a good 2-3 minutes. I'm like, it can't for too long because I get too nervous.
Right, yeah.
And then I drop down and I take a picture, a selfie with the fence and the bear behind me going, gotcha, whatever. And they cursed me out so bad when I came back home. My sister hit me. She's like, what are you doing? Don't you get eaten by a bear? I was like, first of all, look at me. I'm not going anywhere close to bears. Yeah. I'm not built for that.
I'm not doing that. I'll be the first to go.
Yeah. So it was, but it was crazy. Like, the bald eagles up there are like pigeons. They're all over the place. It's so nuts.
They're also, I saw the biggest bird. Like, wait, were they crows? The crows are the size of small people up there.
Yeah. Like, they steal children. They still like have kids. Like,
they steal babies like out of they pull the strollers.
In baby Bjorns. They're just like taking them. Like, here we go.
It's not a joke.
Yeah.
How many siblings do you have?
I have two older sisters.
Okay.
I'm the youngest brother.
Okay. There's actually my sister right here.
Ah, there you go. Older or younger? Younger. Okay. I got a big bro. That's nice. Yeah. I have two kids and I wanted a girl first because I like having an older sister. I think it trained you in a different way to think and understand the species that is woman. But yeah.
For real, right? Or we'd be, because we're cavemen.
That's it. And then also, I think also it helps you with like, with your social, to see your sister's friends and like get mixed into with older girls instead of younger girls. I feel like you understand, like, because they mature quicker, and I think it helps raise you a little bit. So it's I'm clearly the exemplary mature guy, but just like, I think it helps the way you think. So I really wanted a girl first. And I think later in life, it's nice to have, you know, an older sister, like a mom figure to help you out. So, but older bros cool too, because they get kicked butt if you need them to, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think my son's gonna be way bigger than my daughter. My son is my dad was 6'3", and I'm not. I'm like 5'10". And then my wife just took my son to the doctor. I said, oh, he's gonna be like 6'3", 6'4". And I'm like, so he's gonna be the big little brother. He's gonna be like a monster, yeah.
And they're usually right, because I'm the oldest. I have two younger sisters and a younger brother. I'm 7 years older than him. Oh. And at one point, the doctor, when he was like 10, he's like, he's gonna be taller than you. I'm like, no, he's not.
Yeah, because you're tall.
And he is. I'm like, come on, bro.
Stupid doctor.
Yeah, I'm like, he's still my little brother.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. That's funny.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What excites you day to day these days? You seem like someone who is good at driving yourself, but we all go through, you know, our own mental states and peaks and valleys. But, you know, what is your thing that keeps you motivated to keep working as hard as you do? Because you do so much and you do so well at it. Where does that come from?
I mean, part of it is really I'm a results driven kind of guy. So if I give myself like a goal to like do something, it's, I think that's part of it. It's like, okay, I want to like, so after I left the show, I was like, okay, I can't do this now, but I still need to put food on the table, take care of my family. I live to make people laugh. So what can I do here? And I was like, okay. So I talked to my team and my agent was like, he's like, you know, you could do stand up. You've been performing live your whole life. Just, you got to learn that art. And I was like, oh, all right. So I'll do this now. So I started that. And I quickly learned, you know, I had never been on stage by myself. So that was a big thing for me to be like, okay. So I think the challenge of like, okay, how do I put something that I'm proud of out there? Not just a money grab. I didn't want to just be like, come out and see Joe and I'll tell you stories about Jokers. Like, that's not what I wanted to do.
Right.
I didn't want to do a Q&A. I wanted to have original content that you're going to laugh at and get to know me more. The benefit of that was that people saw me as me on the TV show. So if you came to see me, you came to see the guy you knew. So that was,
you got to wink at that, right?
Yeah.
You got to acknowledge that. Yes, also, what's your product, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But also a lot of my stories do, and you know, they're my best friends, still are, you know, I know them 30 plus years. I have plenty of stories to share. So I have stuff to talk about. So I talk about that too, but I also wanted to enhance it with, you know, my perspective on things. And then also more about me being a parent, or, you know, my dog adoption craziness, or, you know, my growing up with a crazy Italian mother in Staten Island, you know, all these things which really formed me. So I figured out what I wanted my night of comedy to be. But most of all, it was going through a time when I was going through some shit. The world has been going through a bunch of shit. And it was like, how can we just forget about all that for a minute?
Yeah.
And hang out and laugh for an hour and a half. So that's really what I just was like, okay, that's my goal. Put something together that people are just going to be in these four walls for 90 minutes and have fun. So that's what I tried to build. And I was happy. I'm happy with what has happened. And people have definitely taken to it, and it's been great. So I think when I'm like, I want to do something, that's it. I'm like, this is what I want to do. So I try to do that at the beginning of every year, to be like, let's do that this year. So
you see, you're results driven.
I'm results driven.
And so what if this year I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
You get to the end of the year and you haven't done that yet. Are you one of those people who just keeps going until you get it, or do you pivot, or does it drive you crazy? Do you get all, is it your tick or what is it? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty self analytical too, where I'll dissect to why it didn't happen. Where a lot of people are like, oh, it didn't happen, ho hum. But I'll be like, why? What could I have done different?
Or why did not?
Yeah, like, yes.
Yeah. Literally, why didn't?
Literally, why did it not happen? What did I do wrong? What did I do right? What could I do? You know. So a lot of focus over the last couple of years have been my personal life and trying to get that stuff back on track, which I'm proud of what I was able to accomplish there. So
that's
then
awesome.
Now I'm figuring, okay, now the next professional thing, what I want to do and all that. So, I mean, I had written during COVID, I had written a kid's book. And I was like, I want to get this published. I love kids' books. I've been doing kids' books for a while.
Why'd you want to do that?
Because I had a fun story with my son. And I was like, it'd be really cool to immortalize this with my son.
Yeah.
About it. It's called Where's Barry, where he lost one of his stuffies one night and he couldn't get his shit together. Mm-hmm. And he was getting totally overwhelmed by it. And we went on a hunt for it. And I just made the story into like a thing. And it's a play on Where's Larry, because I'm always looking for Larry. We named it Barry. So it was like, you know, kind of fun like that. And I was like, you know, this is a cool story. And I was like, you know what? I want to be that for families, because I read to my kids. I love that. I think that's super cool. I was like, to be that book, to be a book in somebody's house, it's a different way for me to be part of a household. And I was always driven by that, because I lost my dad when I was 19.
Oh, wow.
We always watched TV and stuff together. We watched Home Improvement with Tim Allen. The first comedy special I ever saw was Tim Allen's.
One of the goats.
And it was amazing, you know. And my dad introduced, and we laughed together. And that's some of the memories I have of my father that I love. So now when I meet families that are multi-generational, being like, we watch your show together, I'm like, this is awesome, like, to be part of that. So that always resonated with me. So that, I think, becomes a lot, is I'm really focused on legacy. I'm really focused on how to bring joy in a world that's needs it, you know, or people that need to laugh to help themselves. So that really drives me a lot. I think is, I always keep that in the back of my mind, like, what can I do to keep providing that?
How did the loss of your dad at 19 impact your drive and your growth from that point forward?
In a lot of ways, I will say my dad, and you don't know, it's funny because you don't know about this when you think about this. When you think about your parents, a lot of people romanticize the way people perceive them, right? Like, you always think like, not a lot. Some people have bad experience with their parents, some people have good. But the people that have good ones, I think sometimes it's always like, you think there was all like roses and everything all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And then with my dad, I always thought that. And then after he had passed, and the more I talked to people in his world, I realized that genuinely was true. My father was not liked by anyone. He was but he didn't try. He was just genuinely himself and just a nice guy. He's like one of those nice guys that provided for his family, liked being a dad. Like that was his thing.
Good,
you know?
Dude.
Yeah. Like he was a vice president of a insurance sales company. They offered him the presidency twice. He said no both times because he would have had to travel and he didn't want to leave his kids.
Wow.
Which is a lesson I learned the hard way. Yeah, yeah. Super respectable. Didn't chase the dollar, you know, chase the life. And I was like, you know, so that was a cool thing to line up the stars on that with him. But then it was like, you know, when I lost him, I was like, I want to be like him. And that's always when I raise my kids. Like when I go, I'm very, very like about your mortality. When you lose your parents young, you're like very aware of it. From that moment on, you're like, I'm going to die someday. You know, so
yeah,
like that.
You know that as a fact.
100%.
Yeah, yeah. You don't forget that.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you're kids, I feel like it raises you, makes you raise your kids in a different way. I want to have impact as much as I can with that stuff. And so I think that really is a way that it helps me. It's like makes me be a dad who likes to make memories and things that could visit and keep me alive in their mind the same way I do with my dad. I feel like I lost my dad yesterday because I always am like thinking about him doing that.
Yeah. Do you feel like you, as you've gotten older and gone through different hardships and tribulations, that you continue to have like connections like, oh, that's what my dad was probably doing.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? Like, did it never stop?
Yeah. I'll find myself some points that, like, when I do something, I'll go, ha.
I get it now.
Yeah, like that. You know?
I believe that. Yeah.
It's things like that. But my dad, my dad was one of those dads that, like, he loved playing video games. We played Nintendo together. And now I'm playing the Switch with my son. And I'm like, this is so awesome. Like, to do that kind
that's
of
amazing.
Thing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's like little things like that where you get the thing. But I think that the most important thing is, like, you get what it means to make memories with your kids. For me, that was the biggest thing. And so as soon as I had kids, it was like, all right, how do we make memories together? And now I'm super aware of that. And I wasn't very aware of that in the beginning. I was still learning how to be a parent, how to be a partner and all that. And it just took me some time to figure that part out.
Let's talk about making memories. I mean, people just say that's like a, you know, it's like an idiom almost. It's like, but what does making memories mean to you?
The number one thing I do is if my kids ask me to play, I stop what I'm doing and I play with them.
Really?
Can we play? Yes.
Okay.
Whatever I'm doing, can wait.
What do you guys play?
I was a very geeky child. And
no way.
I had a very, I know, crazy. But I was like on the math team. I was a mathlete. Like, yeah, like that. I did like a lot of creative. My first foray into creativity was creative writing. I wrote short stories and I used to give them to my parents and I used to read them. And they were actually pretty good. And my parents always were like, oh, this, you should do this. This is great. And always encouraged that. Right. And it made me actually tell a lot of short stories. And I started playing this game in my neighborhood with my friends called Adventure Games, where I would narrate a whimsical tale of something. Imagine like a Willow or a Lord of the Rings, where we're fighting these elves and everything was in our minds. And I would just narrate these stories. And we did that for a full summer. It was one of my favorite things. So now with my kids, they'll say to me things like, let's play pirates. Like, I remember this very vividly. My daughter goes, let's play pirates. She's 4 years old. I said, sure. Let's play pirates. I don't know how to play pirates. She doesn't know how to play pirates. But we're going
to
play pirates.
We're about to find out.
I was like, well, this looks like a boat. We hopped on this. I said, this is our boat. Come on, we're on a boat. And then I got some of our stuffed animals. I'm like, there's the bad guys. We have to get them. And here's the treasure map, whatever. And I remember like my daughter, like I just started to take control of it. Then I just stopped and I let her take control of it. And then we went back and forth and I just stopped talking and I let her start talking. And she goes, she's like, we had to get the treasure over there. I'm like, okay, we gotta be careful though, because if somebody's gonna stop us. And she goes, a dragon. Now it's dragons where the pirates are. And they go,
weird world. Yeah.
And I'd never been as proud of my daughter in this moment when I looked at her and I said, well, I said, it's gonna be hard to get past that dragon. And she goes, no, it's not that. I go, why? She goes, we have ninjas. And I didn't even know she knew what a ninja was. And I was like, that's my girl. And we kicked those pirates' ass with our ninjas and the dragon. So it was unbelievable to see that. And then I was like, that's a really cool thing. So like for me, those moments, like I know she's going to remember that stuff. But even like my son, like when we go on vacation and stuff, like if he wants to, he's much more meeker, my son, than my daughter. My daughter's an animal. She's like, Dad, look, I could do a flip, and jumps in the pool. I'm like, and I said to my wife, I didn't know she could do that.
On YouTube. What is it?
Yeah. Are you okay? Like, what's going on? And my son is very like, is the water cold? Like, is the water, one of those. So like I'll take time and I'll play with him differently. And I feel like you make memories in different ways. My son loves if I sit there with him as he's like building, like just not even building a sandcastle, just like digging in the sand and counting. He's like me. He's a geek. He loves math. He is.
Yeah.
He knows his times tables are three. Like he's crazy.
That's insane.
And he's just like doing like the digging, whatever, and counting. And I'll just be sitting there and he'll just take my hand and kiss it. And like, I swear. And I'm like, this is unbelievable.
Sweetest shit ever.
I know. It's so crazy.
That's amazing.
You know, so those kind of things for me, and it's like making it together. Like I remember that stuff And they remember that stuff, and they're going to remember that when I'm gone, you know?
I also feel like it's so important to, like you say, like when your daughter mentioned that, well, now there's a dragon, and she's using her imagination now, building this world. I think that, you know, just in life, it's so easy to fall into this, you know, corporate job or whatever it is, yeah. And like you forget about the magic that you can create in your own
100%.
Head. And I think just being able to, or being allowed to do that as a kid,
yeah.
And that being encouraged and supported,
yeah.
No matter what you do,
yeah.
You don't have to be a stand-up comedian.
100%, right.
Just like being imaginative in yeah. life and being able to explore and wanting to
sure.
look beyond what's right in front of you.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel like you're building those things?
I think
and,
so.
It's and they'll cool. be their own people.
It's crazy, yeah. I mean, my daughter's really into music, right? And when every little girl, right, wants to be a singer, right? You think, like, you hear that all the time.
Sure.
It's like, I want to be Taylor Swift, blah, blah, blah. Me and my daughter are talking, and I'm like, you like music a lot. What do you want to do? She goes, I want to be a DJ. She's cool. 8 years old. I'm like, okay, you can be a DJ. Let's be. Right. I was like, a DJ? Really? I was like, okay, cool. She's like, yeah. I was like, you don't want to be. She go. I said, you don't want to be a singer? You don't want to sing? And she goes, nah, I'm not really good at that. And I'm like, you're 8. You don't know what you're good at yet. But also, you have a passion to be a DJ now. I'm like, okay, cool. So we buy her this really cool little DJ toy. Santa brought her a little cool little DJ toy.
Yeah.
And she just rocks out and like DJ. She makes the playlists in the car when we go on road trips. Like she's like just loves music. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool that she's found something she's passionate about.
Amazing. Eight.
Yeah, which is really cool, you know? But I think a lot of it is just I've learned to get out of their own way. My parents were very embraced me in that way where it was like, figure out what you're going to do. Go ahead and try it.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead and, you know, you're going to suck at something. And if you do, but my mom was great at giving me a timeline. I remember when I told her I was moving to LA. So I moved to LA in 2003 to chase the dream of being a film director and screenwriter.
Just because that's what people did.
That's it. That's where you had to, that's the town you had to be in. It was 2003, right? And I ended up selling men's pants at Nordstrom. But my mom-
From baby's pants to men's pants.
That's yeah. it, man. I did. Yeah, that's yeah. all I did. So I started there. But when I left, I remember taking my mom to dinner. And I was like, Mom, I'm going to move to LA. And she goes, okay, how long are you going to be? That's what her answer. And really? I said, I don't know. She goes, nope, 3 years. And I was like, okay. And now just talking to you right now, I guess I realize a lot of my driven timeline stuff comes from my mother.
She put a cap on.
She goes 3 years. She's like, you're not going to go out there and spin your wheels.
You're just in the abyss floating around.
That's it. She goes, you got 3 years to do what you got to do out there. And if you don't make it happen in 3 years, you come back home to your family. That was her answer over our, you know, stuffed shells. And I was like, okay. And that was it. So, and I went out there with in my head that I'd be out there 3 years, which is crazy.
So was it like, you know, 2 years passed and you go, oh shit, I only got a year left.
It all panned out eventually, but I guess it happens what it's supposed to happen. But it ended up coming home. My mom had become a widow at the same time as my grandmother because okay. they both, my grandfather and father had died within 3 days of each other. So my mom went through some shit, but she always had grandma and grandma lived across the street. Then grandma got sick and passed away. So I came home for grandma's funeral. And I don't even know why I said it, but now I guess at this point, as I'm soul searching, I was meant to say it. I just said to her, I said, you know what? Maybe I'll come home for in my mind, I just said, I don't even know why. I just put it out. I said, you know what? Maybe I'll just come home for a little bit. And she cried and hugged me. Said, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I was like, well, I guess I'm coming back. So,
wow.
And that was like 2 years. And I was like, all right, you know what? I'll just come back for a minute and I'll figure it out. And I moved back home. I came home. 30 years old, living in mom's basement.
hey, I was there too, man. Yeah, yeah.
We all get there, right? And then, yeah, it was just a weird thing. And then it actually just put me on the track to be back with the boys here, doing it again. And because when I was living in LA, I was just coming home for shows. And whenever I came home, I was like, hey, I'll be home in May. And Murray would be like, you want to put up an improv show? Let's do it. And we just put up our own self-produced show. So I just was always working with them when I came home, you know? And then when I moved home, I was like, I'm moving back. They're like, all right, let's perform more. And let's do more together. And that's when it started that I was back in the mix. We started doing the video stuff, you know, started getting stuff, sketch comedy and things like that. So,
man, that's super cool. It's yeah. funny that you were talking about how as a kid you used to do creative writing.
Yep.
That was always actually my outlet too.
Oh, was it?
I was the kid who, you know, I was in first grade and my dad had introduced me to this book. It's called Into Thin Air. It's the same author that did Into the Wild, which they made a movie about. It's John Krakauer, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was like, yeah, read this book. And like, I just never really liked reading. And so probably half read it. And I was like, no, I want to write my own story in this setting. And I ended up reading it on my morning announcements at my school.
Ah!
And I just kept doing that over and over again. I told my mom over Christmas and she was like, you know, back then we didn't really know. We were asking our you know, our friends that had kids, like, are your kids doing this shit?
It's fucking weird.
They're like, no, that little nerd up there.
Do you have it still, the story?
I have all of them. My mom kept all this stuff.
Gotta love moms for that, man. That's so great.
And she recorded all the video. Then it went from that to
of course being, your video series. You got
yeah, like
deal.
she was one of my actresses. It's all my siblings. We're doing
of course
dumbest shit ever.
That's
right?
Amazing. Amazing.
It's just funny though how all those things evolved, and I feel like you have a similar
100%.
Story where you've always been that guy, and you kind of realized that yourself, and you've evolved that. In terms of the career, like the success of your career, is there any sort of moment or time period where you remember with the guys on Impractical Jokers where you looked around and said, hey, man, like we're doing something here?
Oh, yeah.
It probably kept going from there, but what was that point where you go, holy shit, y'all?
There was so many. Because
right,
it always built, which was insanity to think about. Like to be, you know, 10 years on TV is crazy to think about that. I mean, most people don't get a second episode.
Man.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
Like it just doesn't happen. You know, so it was like, this is crazy for it to happen. But I remember we had gone, the thing that happened that was weird was when season 2 came out, that's when people knew us. We were filming all of season 1. Nobody knew the hell we were. So it was easy. Season 2 comes out when one hits. And now it's on air and we're filming too. It's like, oh, people now kind of recognizing us as we're going. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
But on Long Island, we love wrestling, right? Sal and Q specifically. There was a wrestling event at Westbury in the Round. I don't know if you guys know this venue, but it's in Westbury, Long Island. It's in the Round. So there's the wrestling matches in the middle, and then there's all these fans.
It's like the real wrestling where people
like real wrestling.
Leave with broken legs.
Yeah, no, it was like a wrestling event for WWE or whoever it was.
Okay.
So we're like, hey, let's go. So we decide to go. We get invited, we go. And I pick the guys up in my car. We go, we drive, we park, we get out, we walk in, and we're sitting there and we're just watching it. And all of a sudden we're like, one head turns, and then two heads turn, and then three heads turn, and then the whole place turns, and we're in the Round. And I'm like, people are recognizing us in a big way here.
Yeah.
And people are like, no way. And then the match ends because they do the middle match things. You know, there's like an intermission, and the place turns around and fucking pins us against the wall. And there is, I'm not kidding, 3,000 people screaming, wanting to take pictures with us. And I'm like, oh, how the fuck do we get out of this? This is insanity. So we're literally pinned in the corner, and we're all looking at each other. And I was like, oh, yeah, could we? And then it starts getting closed. And I knew it. And it starts getting pushed around. And I'm like, and then I was looking, and I saw the exit behind us. And I was like, we got to get the hell out of here. Come on. And I was like, Larry. And everybody starts laughing. And we just fucking ran.
Yeah.
Legit.
Look over
ran
here. We got to go.
And people like came with us, like into the parking lot. We got in my car, and like people like around my car, and we drove away and got out of there. And we were like, what the fuck was that? Like, it was insanity. I was like, I'd never seen anything like that. And we told our management at the time, and then they had talked to the people at the wrestling event. They're like, why didn't you tell us you were there? Because we're huge fans. And it was like, oh, even the wrestlers wanted to see us. Like, we could have been part of the bit. But that was like the first moment I was like, wow, we're pretty famous.
Yeah.
That was a moment where I was like, because I was also like nervous for my safety. and it was like a really weird
thing
that everybody was looking at you. Yeah. So it was really weird. But like things like that. But then of course, like taking the stage at Radio City, I remember taking the stage there and looking out at a theater where me and the boys had gone watching stuff. And we stood there for a minute where the crowd was going nuts, not even being able to talk. We're all overwhelmed with emotion, standing there being New Yorkers on Radio City stage. And we're all like, who's going to talk first? Because we're so choked up, you know? And we're all doing it together, which is such a great thing. Like, you don't have to tell your friends what you're doing. You're doing it with them. There's no jealousy. Everybody's on the come up together. You don't have to explain what your life is. You know, people get it. So those moments always happen for over and over. Like, we did a cruise. I'm like, what the fuck are we doing with the cruise? Nobody's going to come on this cruise. Sold out. Every time. And it's like, who's coming on the boat? Who's going on vacation with us? Like, that's what it was.
I wouldn't even go.
I know. I'm barely going, you know? So it's like things like that, little things like that just keep happening and happening, you know? And then we do the meet and greets at the show. You hear these people's stories about, you got me through this. People find us mostly in hospitals and prisons. That is a true statistic. That's where True TV plays. It plays in hospitals.
But they play
prisons.
Cable TV still.
That's it. And people, that's where, and they're at
in
their
hotels.
Low points. I know. And they're like at their low points, right? They're at like, you know, they're stuck in this hospital, worried about the health. And they find us with laughter.
Yeah.
I've met so many people that have come out of prison and told me, man, this happened, I'm not kidding you, 2 months ago, I'm in Los Angeles. My rental car breaks down. The rental car guy shows up, the tow truck, they have to tow it to LAX. The guy gets out. He's a stout dude. He comes over. He's like, hey, man. I'm like, hey. He goes, holy shit, Joe. I go, yeah. He goes, I just got out of prison 3 months ago. I watched you all the time. I'm like, hey, dude. I'm like, nice to see you. I'm like, how's things? He's like, doing way better now. I'm like, great. He took a selfie and he left into the night. I'm like, that's my life. This is so
living in
weird.
The Matrix.
Like,
what is,
I know. Yeah, it's really, like,
what
weird.
Is this?
You know, so it's like those things like that that always just build up, and you always get reminded of what you mean to people, and it's the fuel for the fire to keep on doing what you're doing. You know, so that's like really the takeaway for me for that.
Do you think that at the end of the day, no matter how hard it is or what your personal drive is, that interactions like that and other people's stories are just really important in terms of just why this should be important to you anymore? Like, I mean, because like, why would you want to keep going at all?
Yeah, you still, right? You don't get numb to it. You don't get numb to it. Like, no matter how many times you hear about it, and even if it feels like the same story, because you've heard it from, you know, over 10 years, I've met how many fans, right?
Sure.
You know, hundreds of thousands of fan people just always tell me these stories. It always feels like the first time, and I always give it the attention it deserves, you know?
Yeah.
And I really feel like that's important, because I grew up, like I said, like, I didn't start till I was 34, right? I was a fan of people before I was famous.
Yeah.
I was a fan to see, like, I remember, like, working in Nordstrom's, I sold Vince Vaughn pants. It was, like, the highlight of my life. I was like,
also,
I love
that's pretty badass
Vince
story.
I love Vince Vaughn.
I've now, never sold him pants.
Is it me? And now I'm friends with him. Like, I met him. Yeah, we did the Nashville Comedy Festival in 2015 or 16, and he was producing it. So we got invited to come do it, and I met him. And then when I met him, I was like, I don't want to bring this up, it might be weird, but I sold you pants. And he goes, what? I said, I worked at Nordstrom in the Grove. I said, and you bought a pair of pants for me. And I said, and it was the highlight of my career. He goes, well, hopefully you're doing much better now.
He's like, you still a size 34? Or you? Like,
you're 36 inseam? But he's a tall drink of water. But he's, you know, it was like things like that where I grew up as a fan of people. So it's never lost on me ever.
Yeah.
When somebody sees me and it's like, oh my God, I'm a fan of you. Like, and because I've been on the other side, which I honestly think is a better side. I love being a fan of people.
It's great.
Fun. It's so great to do that. You know what I mean? So to have that, and I'm still a fan of people now. Like, I'll go out to events as a fan of things, and then I find out they're fans of me, and I'll be like, how do you even know me? It's still like, it's so weird. Like, how am I even on your radar, you know?
Yeah. Who are you fans of, if you don't mind me asking? Would you be starstruck around?
Taylor Swift, hands down.
I mean, of course, yeah.
Of course, T-Swift. But yeah, I went to the Taylor Swift concert with my daughter, MetLife. Talk about making memories. Oh, I saw a core memory on her face as she screamed when she took the stage and realized Taylor Swift is right here in my face. Like, it was crazy.
That's insane.
That was great, yeah. But Bruno Mars was a huge one for me. I didn't know Bruno was a fan of ours, and I'm a huge fan of Bruno's music.
I mean, the guy's amazing.
He's the best. He puts on a great show, you know, and he invited us to a show in Albany, and we went. And they're like, oh, you want to come backstage and meet Bruno? Like, yeah. And he talked to us for like 25 minutes, like quoting stuff from the show. I'm like, how do you like even know this show? And he's like, we watched on the tour bus. He's like, you know, we just watch it. We binge watch it. And that's it. And he's like a true fan and a super nice guy. So it was like things like that. Like, but like Vince, like people that were like my idols, like knowing me and I've had the chance to make laugh. Adam Sandler. It's like crazy. It's just people, Jim Carrey, like people that I grew up being like, this is why I want to do comedy, or like, oh, you're funny. I'm like, what?
Yeah. What does that do? I mean, because it's like a dream come true, but you're also still out here chasing your dreams too.
100%. Yeah, it's so weird. How
does it fit
in?
I'm
in the washing machine, right? I'm just tumbling. Yeah. It's like just running in a circle, like a little hamster wheel.
There isn't, like, do you feel like there's a made it point, or is it not about that?
It's not about that anymore.
Yeah, same here. That's what, like, but let me hear what your take is on that.
I think people haven't made it. You haven't made it point when you don't know what you're trying to make. I think you're like just in your mind, you have set up this, what it feels like to be made, you know, as you're like, I've done it. But then just look in the mirror, be like, would you quit right now?
Right.
Yeah, nobody's going to say yeah to that pretty much if you're doing what you love.
Yeah.
Right. So that was like the big thing for me. So it was like, oh, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. So the making it is just to keep doing it, you know, kind of thing. You know, I just think the balance changes, the shift of focus, the how much you dedicate to it. I think that really is the thing for me. So for the big thing for me was how much time I was dedicating to one thing and how much time I was neglecting from another. And then it's realizing, oh, this is, we're way too much in the red zone here. We got to dial it back, or this is not enough. You're not doing enough to satisfy what's making you happy, to make you a better person and all that. So it is a cycle that way. I think that's the biggest part, is that balance is so hard, so hard.
Which part of the balance?
Like trying to figure out, like, if you're being good enough in every aspect where you're trying to be good. Good enough father, good enough entertainer, good enough husband, you know, good enough family member, you know, whatever it is, whatever you define as, you know, what it is to be good at something.
Because they can kind of pull against each other sometimes.
They don't, like, kind of, they do. They're direct opposites.
Right, it's just like, sometimes it's impossible to be the best at everything in one exact moment in time.
Yeah.
So you have to constantly be aware, right?
The biggest realization is that you can't be the best at everything at once. Mm-hmm. You have to decide what you're going to be the best at right now. And I think that's the biggest learning point for me over the past couple of years was like, what am I going to be the best at right now and not feel the guilt of it one way or the other? It's like, this is what I'm doing right now, but you did it this year. Now you owe this one the best. You got to come back over here. You got to balance it out. So I think a lot of it was like, I'm going to do the best of this, but I wasn't doing much over here. I remember right before COVID, my daughter said to me when I came home, I hadn't been home for like 12 days. She said, Daddy, I love when you come to visit, which is so funny and hurtful at the same time. Like, it's like, I'm doing something wrong. My 4-year-old daughter tells me she loves when I come to visit.
Can I visit?
Like,
yeah, I want to always be.
I know, what are you talking about? I'm like, and then I was like, you're going to be dead soon. Like, you better do something here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's
for real.
It's just a weird, like weird thing to be like, oh, you know, but you're out there getting all the admiration and making people laugh, making other people feel good, but your daughter's missing you. You know, but then you spend too much time here and you feel like you're neglecting what you're supposed to do and you're not feeling fulfilled. So you're not being as good as you are supposed to be here. So it's just a weird balance that you're still, you'll never master. You just have to do your best to manage it, I guess, is the best word.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't want to ask the overly asked, dumb, boring question at this point about you leaving Impractical Jokers, yeah. But I'm just going to
appreciate that.
yeah. Also, because it's like, I already kind of assumed that it was what you're kind of saying right now.
Yeah.
Like, where it's like, you're prioritizing things. Also, what's cool that I've noticed is like, you're also living out your dreams too, yeah, as the guy who started this as well.
Yeah.
So it's not like even like that.
Yeah.
I mean, TMZ would want it to be that way.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
But like, was there a moment where you said, hey, I want to start prioritizing X, Y, Z. And then you got to start taking action on those things though, right?
Well, yeah. I mean,
which might feel uncomfortable and scary and weird. And you got to let people know stuff. And it's like,
yeah, I mean, that's going through it all in the public eye is the hardest part. And look, there's a lot of personal things that I'm not going to discuss with anybody because
I don't even want you to tell them.
Yeah, exactly. No, which I appreciate too. But it's more of like, it's like when you're, you know, like your whole family's falling apart and you've got things that you have to deal with and all that. It's like, well, this is what's happening. And then, you know, sorry if you don't like it, but this is what's happening.
I'm a real person. So
I know this is what happens.
Yeah. Aren't you dealing with some shit too?
Yeah. I know. Right. So that's it. And then, you know, and then when you're able to like take your time and feel like you've made some strides and do things and like, you don't have to know what's next and you don't have to know what the next piece is, you know, and people are always like, oh, well, what are you doing? Are you going to, and I'm like, I don't know what's happening next and I'm fine with that. So you need to be fine with it. You know, it's like, I don't owe that to anybody and I just need to do what I think is best at the moment. And that's what I'm doing. So that's a hard lesson to learn as a person who is trying to be an entertainer and be in this world where it's have to be a little bit selfish with like, look, it's okay to not know. We'll see what happens kind of feel, you know?
So where's your headspace now? It seems like you're very family focused with like
100%.
And so, and you know, things evolve, you know, kids grow up and kind of shifting back towards your career and the future of, you know, all the wonderful things I'm sure you're still going to do in your life.
Yeah.
What are some of those goals that you'd like to have accomplished
as an
entertainer?
Well, one of them for me, another medium that's awesome is podcasts.
Yeah,
and well, I do. Yes, I have podcasts,
I've also been a fan of it.
Oh, great! Yeah, so I love doing that podcast, and it's been really fun. And I'm looking forward to like giving that the time and attention and love it needs after the tour ends. And I'll have some there. And me and Steve are really excited about it and love it. And I love the format because it gives back. You know, as funny as it is, it's really about helping people with their dilemmas as best we can.
Right.
You know, and making people shine light into that stuff. So, you know, the Two Cool Moms, it's really fun. It's named after, it's an homage to our mothers, which is great. I love my mom, it's great to have her live on in that. And I get to relive memories of her and keep her alive in my mind every day. So like things like that is really fun. And to work with, we're doing it with iHeart too, which is just, I grew up in New York. I know I love that brand. I was just like, it's cool to be a part of that like kind of family, which is really fun. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm okay to say that.
Shout out to Connell.
So
it's actually an iHeart show.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. So it worked out.
Yeah, we're good.
So like to be, you know what that's like to actually feel like be part of that family and stuff. Like I grew up going to Jingle Balls and doing all that. Yeah,
and
stuff.
And they're they still slap.
Yeah, no, it's great. Still always. Awesome. Yeah. You know, I take my kids to them. So, but you know, to do that, that was like a medium. I was like, okay, I want to do something that I'm proud of here in that space too. So Two Cool Moms is becoming something that I'm going to focus on to make it what I think would be really the best version of it. And me and Steve are excited about that. So that's definitely on the horizon. The kids book that I have coming out, that's another thing where I had a lot of fun making it, and I made it just kind of like, cause I was like, oh, I'll make this. But then I had so much fun with the process, with the illustrator, working with the illustrators and stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like,
that was so fun.
Can you describe what it might look like at all without giving it away? And we can cut this if you don't want it to be out yet.
Yeah,
I'm just curious.
No, it's more like I gave it to the nostalgia of, I actually gave them pictures of my bear growing up.
Okay,
my bear that I still have, my bear.
You still have it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's impressive.
He's in storage in the closet. But I sleep with him every now and again. I'm not going to lie.
Manhattan,
I'm not
going to
lie. A couple years ago, I took him out of the closet and I was hugging him for a minute. So I sent him pictures of me and the bear, and he did a version of my son, like a cartoon version of my son and a cartoon version of my bear. So it's kind of cool like
that's
that.
That's so cool.
Which
man.
Is really fun. And a couple of cartoon versions of one of my favorite dogs that's in the book. Yeah, so that was cool. And I was like, oh, this is fun. I actually want to do this again with a different lens, right? Because it's all evolving too. Like you do the first one because you're like, oh, this is fun.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you know what? But this is actually could be really cool because I have a new, totally different idea because I'm thinking about this now. So I was like, oh, now what would be another kid's book I would do? And I started thinking about that and I came up with so many fun ideas. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do another one because now I have the lens of not like, oh, I had this idea. Could we do this? And now it's like, hey, I did this. What's another way I could do this and do it better? So I think that's a cool thing, you know, so I have goals like that and stuff, you know, but I want to take some trips with the family and, you know, do things like that. So,
it's funny that you said that, you know, you had this idea for a children's book and which is something brand new for you, but, and you're making this, it's happening. And then it made you think that you wanted to look at this through a different lens. And I took that as, okay, I did this. How do I build on that?
Right.
Versus just do that again.
Tick a box. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So what is that to you?
Yeah, I think it's to, when you do it the first time, people are like, oh, you learn the lessons and you move forward. I look at it more like you don't make the same mistakes when you do something the first time, right?
Right.
So it's not like a lesson learned. It's like, okay, these are the things. Because at the end of the day, you accomplished it. Great. Good work.
Yeah.
Who does? Don't forget. You know, you could be like, oh, I could have done that better. Like people say that all the time.
Too late now.
That's 100%. And people, like New Year's resolutions, people say that all the time. And I heard this thing that recently, and it was like, don't forget to thank the person who got through last year before you tell them what they did wrong. And I was like, that is a huge thing that really resonated
that's
with me,
real.
Which is really cool. So I think the same thing with any project you do. It's like, oh, I could have done this better. Fuck that. You did it.
Yeah.
You did great. What could you do different?
Yeah.
What would you learn? What were the mistakes that you wouldn't make again? And I think that's the way to look at it. Instead, it's go from a place of positivity. So for me, it's like, okay, this was a kid's book. I had a cool idea. It kind of just slapped together. And I was like, oh, this is actually, when I saw the first drawing, I went back to the words and I was like, let me fix this and make it cooler. And I did. And I had a second draft. And they're like, you don't need a second draft. This is approved. I'm like, yeah, but I want one. And I went and I did that. And I was like, now it feels like it's something I can
do
that, you know? So I think that's it. Look at the lens of how to make it better instead of what I did wrong.
Or dwelling on the past. I mean, 100%. You could look at the first pilot episode of Impractical Jokers and say,
it's atrocious.
Well, you would do everything differently.
I know.
But how do you even know that you would if you hadn't gone through all those things? You only know that now.
That's it.
Right? That's a hindsight thought.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look back and regret or feel whatever, or just keep applying. to the next thing, yeah. Right? Man, I like it. When I make a podcast, I'll listen to it usually one time, like when it's too late. I'll listen to it in my car on the way to the office when I know that
it's been published 4 hours ago.
Down, and then I'll never do it again.
That's great.
But almost as an exercise, just to be like, okay, I'll remember what I wanted to change. I'll never forget it, to be honest. But just apply to the next thing, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Keep building it, right?
Yeah, it's all about building. It's all about building, you know?
Ever thought about, and this may be too early of a conversation, but this children's book sounds so cool. Like a movie imagination of this or something? Like that'd be super badass.
For sure.
You're talking about how you were a writer, creator in that way. I mean, obviously those are hard things to do, but that would be a sick.
For sure.
I don't know. Like, do you think like that?
Yeah, well, like I told you in the beginning, I wanted to be a writer-director when I grew up. That's always what I wanted to do. So I have a movie script I'm working on now, which is a live-action movie, it's an action comedy. So I'm out working with that now and hopefully going to get that made and directed this year. That's my goal for this year, a big one for me.
Dude, I love
that. It was like, you know, Jokers I loved, it was great, but it felt like sometimes it feels like a 10-year tangent because it was like, this was great. And it was great, but I always wanted to write and direct. And it was like, I learned a lot from that and I could actually move it. And I was like, oh, let me apply everything I know now to directing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is really cool. And I got to do the Jokers movie, which was so great to do.
Also, I'm so glad you were doing that. I love how it looked different stylistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Thanks. Like, I was like, this is cool. A great idea.
That was fun. And we got to like check off some major, because a lot of ideas were like, this would be great to do, but the TV screen is too small.
We
need something bigger.
We need some more time.
Yeah, time and like, you know, real estate on the screen, you know. So it was fun to be able to do that. But like things like that. So to be able to do this, the movie is like that's probably my next biggest thing. It's like, this is what I want to do. I want to write and direct a film. So
there's a thing that I sort of learned where, I mean, creative people or people who have creative endeavors, dreams, regardless of how old you are, where you are in your career, you know, it can be a very intimidating path, right? Like, what advice would you give to somebody who is just struggling with how difficult it can be and where to go next? Because you've probably felt that more times than a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you found yourself somewhere else. And what'd you do to get there? How'd you change it in your brain? And
I think a lot of it comes with age, to be honest, because I don't know, like, if it happened younger, how I would handle a lot of it all. But I think the biggest thing for me is like, nothing gets started till it gets started. So, and the only person that could start something is yourself, right? So a lot of people get in their own way. They look at the ways people do things and how they've done it and what's the right steps, and there's no plan for anybody. Everything happens by accident. You could look at 1,000 different famous people or 1,000 people that you look up to in your industry, say you want to be an actor, and how those people got there is 1,000 different stories. There's no, the only thing that's the same is that they wanted to do it. So if you want to do it, you just have to start doing it. So for me, it was like, when I wanted to like start writing stories, I just sat down and started writing a story. When I wanted to try out a kid's book, I sat down and started writing what I thought a kid's book would look like. When I wanted to, you know, when I wanted to write a movie script, I was like, here's an idea for a movie. Let me flesh this out. But then the other thing I always think that helps is to find people to help you if you don't know what you're doing that are good at what they do. So like for me with comedy, me and the guys were always very strong together because we always knew how to make each other funny and we knew how to help each other with that. So I think that was a big thing, even creating our live show. When we first did our live show to go out as the Jokers, Impractical Jokers Live, when we first started touring 8 years ago as a troupe, it wasn't just like, hey, we're going to go on the road and talk about being Jokers. It was like, what's our show?
Yeah.
We built a show and we analyzed it and we said, you should say this and you should do that. And we all worked together.
Let's perform, you know, this thing.
100%. Yeah. So like we were literally performing it to no one and working on this thing for a long time. And then, you know, when I wrote my screenplay, it was like, all right, I know my story, but I don't know how to really write screenplays. So I talked to my agents and stuff and they found me a great co-writer and he helped me with all about how it goes and the when you should be hitting each thing in an act, stuff I didn't know. And I learned that from him and got better at that. So I got out of my own way. Cause if I just sat down and tried to write a script, it'd be like, I don't even know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, but I had the story. So I'm like, okay, how do I tell the story? Help me. And you get somebody.
Yeah.
Help,
right. And you acknowledge that.
100%.
There's also like, I mean, you said, okay, I want to write a kid's book. I'm going to sit down and write a kid's book. And obviously you knew that you needed help with certain aspects of it.
Yeah.
But I would imagine for some people it would be very easy to say, okay, the whole just do it line is fine. But then there's a moment there where I'm sure that you're questioning, like, man, like, is this the right thing in the moment? And it takes a minute to get some sort of validation that you're going somewhere okay.
Yeah.
And so how do you, like, keep it going in that part?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Right? I mean, just look, if you look at my comedy career, like 18 years of doing comedy before I was even anybody knew who I was or got paid to do it in any real way.
Sure.
I mean, so that was just doing it because I felt like that's what I should be doing. And there was no right way to do it or wrong way to do it, and I wouldn't change any of it, you know? But we were putting up shows for 50 people here in Manhattan that 20 people would show up, and we'd end up like losing money,
right?
Having to pay the venue $20 at the end of the day to, cause we didn't sell enough tickets. But it was more like, just, if you're looking for the validation and if it's not coming from yourself, I really think you're doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. So what is the validation for you?
It's that when I feel inside that I've made somebody smile, or if I feel somebody, I made something funny or something that makes, I guess, sparks what I felt growing up, is really like the navigator for me. So if I feel like I'm able to, you know, make either somebody laugh or feel good or forget how terrible life is or do whatever it is in that moment that I get out to do, I think that's a big part of it for me. It's like, I feel like I've provided something to the world that made it a little bit better.
Outside of that, which is amazing, is there any sort of, hey, I'm proud of myself?
There was that for a while.
Or just like the, not in the sense of I check the box, I achieved the objective, I got the results.
Yeah.
For your own personal regimen or something, or what is that to you?
No, there was, yeah, there's some, like when I got that 50th state and I had put that on my thing,
that's
really cool.
That's just for you, man.
Yeah, that means nothing to anybody.
Yeah,
that,
right,
was, yeah, that was like, me. You know,
I don't have that though.
But it was more like, you know what, I set that goal for myself that doesn't really, no one cares about that. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to do it. And when I did that, I was like, that's pretty cool that I was able to do that. But, you know, it's either little moments or huge milestones. And I've been fortunate enough to have them across the board, you know, playing the O2 theater, you know, in London, playing the O2 arena 5 times, sold out across the world. It's crazy that we were able to do that. And then it's like, it's nuts. And now, like, I'm like, the first time I was able to do a stand-up comedy show by myself in Appleton, Wisconsin, in front of 200 people, has the same kind of merit, because it feels like I accomplished something that seemed insurmountable to me, where I was like, how the hell am I going to do a stand-up comedy show by myself? I don't really necessarily know what I'm doing yet.
It sounds terrifying.
It does, yeah. And then being like, what the hell am I doing in this arena? You know, I have imposter syndrome. I'm like, taking the stage, are you kidding me? This, you know, and it just feels a little nutty, and you have those moments all across the way.
So in the green room, getting ready for that first one, and you've prepped, and but you're still like, I don't know how this is gonna go. What's that feel like in that moment?
I mean, I was fortunate enough, I had Steve Byrne with me and Jiggy, who's my other comic. He's my comic and tour manager. He opens for me. He's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And they're both really good at stand-up comedy. And like I said, if I know I want to do something, but I need people to help me get there, I take the best with me. You know what? I'm going to do my first show. It's going to be an hour and 20 minute show. You guys do 30 minutes each, and then I'll cop up and do 35 minutes.
That's a lot of material.
Yeah. Like. So I was like, I'll do 35 minutes for my first time. So I got up there. I did 30. I ended up doing 37 minutes for my first one. And then I got off stage and I came back to Steve, and Steve's one of my best friends. He's a great guy. And I just said, he's been doing stand-up comedy forever. And I remember this explicitly. He was sitting there, he had a rocks glass, he was drinking a scotch. And I go, so? He goes, fuck you. And he took a 7. I said later, he goes, I've been doing this for 20 years. He's like, you just get up there and you talk for 40 minutes and everybody laughs. He's like, just shut up. And we started laughing. And I'm like, seriously, he goes, Joe, he's like, honestly, he's like, you just got to find out what more you're going to say. So I was like, all right. And he goes, tomorrow, he's like, we're only doing 10 minutes each. And I said, no, I said, do 15. So they did 15 and I ended up going for like 45. And it was like really cool that he was like, do it. He's like, you could do it. Just keep talking. You'll find what to say. And I did that, and I started going. And after I came back, I had my notes, and I was writing up everything. And we just kept building. And I started in these little comedy clubs. And then people started coming out. And I ended up doing all these shows because they all got sold out. And I was like, and my manager was like, you could do theaters. He's like, you could do spend one night in Boise instead of being at the comedy club all weekend. And he's like, and then we can move you along if you want to start doing that, if you're ready for that. And I was like, I said, I don't know if I'm ready for that. And he's like, well, he's like, the world, he's like, people want it. He's like, so you're the only one getting in your own way. And I remember that. And I was like, I don't want to get my own way.
Wow.
I said, all right, let's do it. And then when I got on the theater stage, I was more comfortable on theaters because I'm a very physical comedian, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I had I was on a comedy club stage, I was like a caged bird. I was like, I couldn't do it. I was afraid of falling off the people right here.
You don't have to
stop moving. Right.
You can't do whatever the fun stuff, right?
That's right. I'm a panther up there, man. I'm all over the place. You know, I don't stop moving. So when I got on a theater, I actually think I got better. I was on a more comfortable space for me. I was able to use my body. I came up with like 3 or 4 jokes where I was doing full-blown like runs and like doing weird body things. And I was like, oh, I couldn't do these in the comedy because there were different tags. Yeah. And it just made me better. And I was like, oh, that's what I needed. I needed this kind of thing. So to do that and be like nervous in the back, but also feel prepared was a weird feeling for me. So in the green room, I'm like super nervous, but I feel like I've done the work. And it's like when you get off stage, it was like, oh, you did it. You were right. You were prepared.
Yeah.
And you could get better at this. So
yeah. So it's nervousness right before it starts.
For sure.
And there's a lot of it just in anticipation, right?
It's more the anticipation, I think. Because I'm not a nervous person and I hadn't been nervous for a long time because I was, even with the big shows.
But like, this is important to you as well.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of in that sort of headspace too.
And by yourself for the first time.
By yourself.
And if you bomb, you're bombing. There's nobody to turn to.
There's no one to say, right?
Yeah. Look at this guy. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't do it. So yeah, that was the biggest obstacle for me was being by myself on stage.
So when did it go away? Like, did you hit the stage and all of a sudden you just going? And you lean into your
like black
improv, just like, hey, what just happened back there?
Yeah, here's a story. It felt like that. Yeah, it was like a whirlwind of like, just going. When you get the laughs, they start coming, they start building, they're laughing more, and you're like, oh, you got this. And then before you know it, you look up and time's up, and it's like, oh shit, that's crazy.
Yeah, because you have all these, you know, I'm sure jokes and stories.
Stories, yeah. The good thing about it is, like, being a storyteller, I feel was easier for me because I'm a storyteller and I tell a funny story. Like,
you're one of the goats, dude.
Like, oh, thank you, bro. I appreciate that. So I just know I'm confident in that. So I'm like, all right, if I find stuff that's interesting enough to talk about, I could do it. And so then I just started lining up. And then when I look at my life, I'm like, I have so many fucking stories. Right. It's like, are you kidding me? So it's like, oh, okay, so which ones am I not going to tell? You know?
Yeah.
So that was really, I think that was a big turn point for me to be like, this is my this is the Joe Gatto version of stand-up. This is my stand-up I'm telling stories and giving my perspective on them. So I think that's when I realized that, it got way smoother.
Real quick before we head out, tell me about your podcast.
Two Cool Moms. It's a podcast with me and Steve Byrne where we basically had two cool mothers and we like to, who gave great maternal advice, and we like to think we inherited that gene. So we spend the first half of the podcast talking about anything and everything in between because we're two comedians. So we talk about life, growing up, our kids, whatever it is. And then the second half, we take fan submitted dilemmas and solve them to the best of our abilities. And
what kind of dilemma?
Good or bad or always funny. Yeah.
Just like girlfriend stuff? Or like
a lot of relationship stuff we get, but one of the biggest ones we've been getting a lot was, how do I make friends as a grown-up if I don't have kids? And that's a big one that a lot of people have been submitting.
Like, you just don't.
I was like, you don't.
Can't.
That's it. You're okay. Yeah. You're going to die alone. we always talk about that for in depth, and people give their life experiences about it and stuff too. And we'll help them with that. But one of the big ones is like, it all starts with talking to strangers, because every best friend starts as a stranger. And like, that's really what it is. You know? So it's like, you just have to get out of your comfort zone and talk to people. It may be weird. You might be talking to the wrong people. And then the other thing people have to come up with too, is that not everybody's going to be a friend.
Yeah.
Some people just be an acquaintance.
People also just suck.
Go through. Yeah. More people suck, you know? So you're also interviewing people if you want them to be in your life, you know? But I think that's a big part, is just get out of your comfort zone, talk to strangers, and you never know who you're going to be friends with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're excited to get back at it because it's been so much fun.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear it, man.
Yeah.
Thanks. And honestly, I'm honored to have
this
talked
to you. This is so cool, man. You're great.
Like, for real.
This is the best.
Big fan, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Talking to Death is a production of Tenderfoot TV and iHeart Podcast, created and hosted by Payne Lindsay. For Tenderfoot TV, executive producers are Payne Lindsay and Donald Albright. Co-executive producer is Mike Rooney. For iHeart Podcast, executive producers are Matt Frederick and Alex Williams, with original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Additional production by Mike Rooney, Dylan Harrington, Sean Nerney, Dayton Cole, and Gustav Wild for Cohedo. Production support by Tracy Kaplan, Mara Davis, and Trevor Young. Mixing and mastering by Cooper Skinner and Dayton Cole. Our cover art was created by Rob Sheridan. Check out our website, talkingtodeathpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Talking to Death.
This series is released weekly, absolutely free. But if you want ad-free listening and exclusive bonuses, you can subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus on Apple Podcasts or go to tenderfootplus.com.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.